Hello, and welcome to TwerpCast episode 69, Into Darkness Cast. We will be discussing Star Trek Into Darkness, spoiler free. But let me explain. Spoilers are free, not absent. They cost no money, but they will be present. I would like to introduce you to the spoiled executive producer of TwerpCast, Jim Caswell. And yes, he really is the illegitimate child of James T. Kirk.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, the mastermind behind TwerpCast, and the man who's sitting here in a red shirt with expendable written across the front of it.
As if I needed to advertise. So yes, we are going to be discussing Star Trek Into Darkness. And no, this will not be spoiler free.
We give you fair warning now. If you have not seen the movie, stop, save, and come back to us after you've seen it. We take no responsibility for any spoilers that ruin things for you. You listen at your own risk.
Or, as a beloved science fiction show would say, warning, warning, Will Robinson.
Spoilers. I think we should start at the beginning.
First, there was Big Bang Theory. And then...
If you're interested in the history of Star Trek and all that other good stuff, please feel free. There are at least four or five episodes that precede this where we go on and 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 on about Star Trek. It's one of our favorite topics. Please forgive us. So we're not going to go delving down that road again. Instead, we're going to fixate solely on this movie, Star Trek XII.
So... probably the biggest complaint that I have heard with this movie is it does not honor the Gene Roddenberry vision of Star Trek. Jim, do you think this movie does or does not honor the version of Star Trek created by Gene Roddenberry?
I believe that the crew of the Enterprise uphold the vision of Gene Roddenberry. The universe around them is gray, but the crew themselves uphold the vision that Gene Roddenberry had, and that is, in spite of the fact that all these people come from different backgrounds and different histories and different worlds, they are able to put aside their differences to come together for the betterment of mankind.
I would go actually a step further than what you have said, and I think I know what you were leading to. I would like to come back to that. There's one reason this movie would not get four pens in the pocket protector from me, and it's that gray area you're talking about. I think that anyone who would say that Star Trek Into Darkness does not follow Gene Roddenberry's vision either A, hasn't seen it, or B, doesn't actually understand what Gene Roddenberry was trying to do anyways. This movie starts out with a 10 or 15 minute morality play about why the Federation has a prime directive. Yes, it was directed by J.J. Abrams, and yes, it's a very fast-paced action 15 minutes. But it completely sets the tone of the Star Trek universe that we're in. It's going to be fast-paced, it's going to have a lot of action, and there's going to be a morality tale.
And hard choices have to be made.
Absolutely. And so, is the movie paced like an episode of Star Trek? No. Absolutely, you cannot pace a 2.5 hour movie like you did, you know, the 53-minute episode of Star Trek and then intercut commercials. Does it have all of the plot elements of Star Trek? It has the morality tale. It has the incredible villain. Does it have the technobabble? Ironically, even though they don't say things like, we have to reverse the polarity of the lithium crystals, they don't say that. And yet they still have to align the warp core for no apparent reason. So there is some ambiguity and some gray areas in this. Do you still think it is Star Trek?
I believe that it is more Star Trek than some of the Star Trek was, especially the later day stuff. I think that this is more upholding of Gene Roddenberry's vision of Star Trek than all of Voyager. Probably season 3 of Enterprise. Basically all of the Star Trek that I'm not that fond of, but I still watch anyway because, I'm that big of a fanatic.
I would agree with that. I think Star Trek Voyager was a big heaping pile of things that came out of my rear.
No. You didn't eat anything that rotten so that you would expel it from your body.
Yes.
For example, the beginnings of Voyager were rooted in the idea of Federation turning against Federation, and Federation being betrayed by Federation. There are traces of that in this movie, but the reasons behind the betrayal are completely different. In the Voyager term, the Federation has turned its back on its people out of convenience because they don't want to start trouble with the Cardassians. Therefore, the Maquis have to strike out on their own, feeling as though their government isn't supporting them anymore. In the case of this movie, it's because the person has a rather warped and demented idea of how to defend the Federation, but his goal is still to defend the Federation. He still sees himself as a loyal member of the Federation who has not been betrayed by his own people.
Well, this is where I was going when I talked about the gray area. And of the television versions of Star Trek, this is what I did not like. I did not like the whole idea of the Maquis and the Federation. I did not like the whole idea of Section 31, which might as well have just been called the Evil Federation. Going straight on to the movies, Star Trek Insurrection, which otherwise was a really good story, the Federation were the bad guys. And Star Trek Into Darkness, although the main bad guy was the John Harrison character, events were started because the Federation bad guy.
It's funny that you mentioned Section 31, probably because it's so close to the top of your mind right now. Again, spoilers! Section 31 makes an appearance in this film. When they said Section 31, I legitimately felt my eyes roll to the back of my head. The thought that went through my head was, oh my god, they brought up Section 31, one of my least favorite parts of the Star Trek universe, and they included it into this film. What are they doing? And then I realized, oh my god, they are actually using Section 31 right. They're not using it as this clandestine organization that is completely untouchable. They're using it as a black ops part of the Federation that has come to light.
That's a good way of putting it. Don't know if I would go so far as you saying they used it right. However, it certainly was not as bad as the use on Deep Space Nine.
I always disliked the idea of Section 31. I never really felt like Section 31 was loyal to Gene Roddenberry's vision.
Section 31, to me, always felt like a convenient plot device. It was not an organic part of the story. It didn't evolve out of what had been written for Star Trek or The Next Generation or even the preceding stories in Deep Space Nine. It seemed like we need an evil overall arching bad guy. Let's create him. His name is Doomsday in Superman, and his name is Section 31 in Star Trek. Doesn't logically flow with the story, it's just convenient.
See, in a lot of ways, comparing Section 31 to Doomsday or Bane is almost giving Section 31 too much credit, in my opinion. And keep in mind that I hate the characters Bane and Doomsday because they were specifically created for the purpose of destroying the lead character. I almost feel like Section 31 was created specifically to be Spectre so they could have Dr. Bashir be 007.
I can't argue with that. That's very true. But my point stands that it just came out of nowhere.
Right. Like Bane and Doomsday.
Yes.
So they do manage to use Section 31, and it isn't this inorganic thing. It's a cog within the mechanism of the Federation. A cog that proceeds to get blown to Kingdom Come.
Yes, and that's apparently where it needs to be anyways. But I'd like to step back a second, and one of the things I discussed a couple of minutes ago is the fact that J.J. Abrams doesn't make heavy use of technobabble. And I'd like to know kind of your opinions on, do you miss it or not?
To be honest, I didn't notice that it was missing, so no, I can't say that I necessarily missed it. I've become so accustomed to technobabble that its presence or lack thereof isn't something that automatically draws my attention.
I've heard from at least one source that they really missed this, and I really wanted to smack that person upside the head, because I know by the end of Voyager that technobabble and Star Trek were almost synonymous, but if you really go back and watch the original series, it was not there. The technology simply was there. They didn't try to explain how a transporter works. When they took Spock's brain out of his body, they didn't try to explain how the belt kept him alive. It just did. And I think this is actually more a return to the original Trek than a departure from it. You know, there's a device in this movie that can calm an active volcano. They never tried to explain how the device works. They just simply said, it works.
It's a giant ice cube.
They kind of said that. And I actually appreciate the fact that they didn't try and insult my intelligence by teaching me how an imaginary technology works in imaginary words. Just use Arthur C. Clarke's maxim. Any technology significantly advanced will seem as magic. And to me and you, a device that can stop an active volcano is magic.
While there was a lack of technobabble, there was no lack of technology, to the point where it puts Galaxy Quest's engine room to shame.
If you haven't seen Galaxy Quest starring Alan Ruck and Tim Allen, you really need to.
And Sigourney Weaver. In Galaxy Quest, there is a segment where they have to go into the engine of the ship, and...
we could actually call this the Engine Room of Doom.
And there are so many devices in this engine room that can kill you that it is preposterous. To the point where the actors are saying, "This is preposterous! Who designs an engine room like this?" I kind of had the same feeling towards the end of the movie when one of the lead characters is crawling around in the engine.
And there's a warning. Don't go in there. It'll kill you. Well, then why did you design it like that?
To the point where it's actually rather humorous. It also builds up to one of the scenes that honestly made me roll my eyes significantly, but other people seem to really enjoy it. Again, spoilers. At this point, we cannot warn you enough. Do not go beyond this point if you don't want parts of the movie ruined for you.
Before you go on, because I know exactly where you're going now, I do have another question for you. I think we both agree already this is a good movie.
Yes.
Would this movie be as good if we hadn't seen Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan?
Honestly, I think I probably would have enjoyed it even more if I hadn't seen Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. It would have made these scenes that I'm getting ready to talk about more significant.
I don't know. I'm not sure I agree, but I can't say, "Jim, you're wrong." And I often feel that way, but in this case, I can't just say that.
You often feel that way. You often say it.
Yes, because so much of this movie, to me, hinges on the fact that you need the knowledge from Star Trek II for scenes and like certain action points to make sense.
In order to properly make the comparison contrast between the two, yes, you need to see the first one, or in this case, the second Star Trek film. But if you were a newbie, and you got to keep in mind that these two movies weren't just made to keep the Star Trek franchise going, but they were meant to bring in new people. So I'm trying to look at it from the point of view of a brand new Trekkie, someone who hasn't seen anything of Trek before these two movies.
That predication is exactly what I'm trying to get at with my question, and I don't know that I can answer it, not honestly, but unbiasedly would be the answer, because obviously I've seen the Star Trek II. So yes, that's what I'm trying to get from you. Is Star Trek Into Darkness as good a movie without having seen Star Trek II?
I think it's as good, but in a completely different way. I think that if you are seeing the scene where Kirk and Spock are talking to each other about being friends as one of them lay dying in radiation inside the engine room, I think that just watching Star Trek Into Darkness and seeing that scene, I believe that it was a dramatic enough scene that you could enjoy it. I think, as with any double-edged sword, I think you can catch the long-term Star Trek fans with the back end of the sword and say, "Look at what we've done here. We've reversed the roles so that it's the other person who's dying. I did warn you about spoilers, remember? And look at how we did this. Look how we twisted this up. And look at it and compare it to Star Trek II. In Star Trek II, it's Spock who's laying dying. In Star Trek Into Darkness, it's Kirk who's laying and dying. Look how we mix these two things up, and look how history repeats itself. Isn't this cool?" And I believe that in that regard, yes, it's very cool. But I think the scene standing on its own is also a very dramatic scene.
I would agree with you. I was in near tears.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far.
You were in tears.
No, actually, I was slightly rolling my eyes because, to be honest, there was a part of me that was sitting there going, "Come on, guys. I was really hoping that you were going to start going in your own direction and start writing original stories and start plowing your own path in the Star Trek universe." I did feel just a tad bit gypped that for Star Trek 2.0 number 2, they went back to Star Trek 2.
I'm kind of glad they did. And this is actually weird because it's the alternate universe. It's neither Space Seed nor The Wrath of Khan. It's something original entirely. And yet, as you said, history repeats itself. So we have this 5 or 10 minute moment that's almost right out of Star Trek II.
Like I said, I enjoyed it, but I was in that very fine line between enjoying something and also being disappointed at the same time. And as long as we've spoiled that much for you, don't worry. Kirk does get better.
Thanks to Khan Noonien Singh, as a matter of fact.
Although I am going to say, Spock looking to the heavens and yelling out, Khan! I broke down laughing. I mean, I know that it was supposed to be a dramatic moment, but oh, I couldn't help myself. The parallels with Star Trek II, that was one too many.
I disagree, but that's okay. Next question for you, Jim. What do you think of the J.J. Abrams Klingons?
I wish we had seen more of them. Again, I like the fact that they hit on all of the key ingredients. The warriors, the honor-bound, the key elements of what we've come to know as the Klingons were there, including the head ridges. The fact that we only got to see one of them without their helmet, and yes, they do have the ridges. Like I said, I kind of wish that we'd seen more of them. I really hope down the line the Klingons get used more.
I kind of think they're really heading that way. Yeah, I agree. We needed to see them more. They were really a throwaway. I guess the real reason for them to be there was to show just how kick-ass Khan is. But I think one of the best lines in the whole movie comes out of that scene.
The reason you brought me along, Captain, was because I can speak Klingon. Let me speak Klingon! Oh, one other thing that I noticed, and it's strictly because I'm an aficionado of sharp and pointy things. They took the Bat'leth, and I think somebody said, hey, the 4-point Bat'leth looks kind of cool, but wouldn't it look so much more kick-butt if it had 8 points on it? And whoever did that doesn't understand the basic principles behind the Bat'leth. And yes, I am a big enough geek that I know the general principles behind the Bat'leth.
Did look cool, though.
To your average person, yes, I bet it did look cool. I was sitting there going, wow, that is a completely unfunctional weapon.
Looked cool.
So did the explosions, gunfights, and car chases. Spaceship chases.
Yes. Now, as much as I love J.J. Abrams, and I do think that he stays true to the original Star Trek, he is kind of the Michael Bay of Star Trek.
Oh, I really wish you hadn't insulted J.J. Abrams that way. But yeah, he does know that your average audience really loves car chases, explosions, and gunfights. The only thing that differentiates him from Michael Bay is that he also believes in telling a story.
Yes, he has things like plot and characterization and drama. Michael Bay, are you listening? Plot, characterizations, and drama.
Yeah, you're going to have to draw him pictures for those. And then he'll proceed to blow them up.
There are two things that Michael Bay likes to see blown up, and they're both on Megan Fox's chest.
Speaking of which, let's talk performances. Because Michael Bay doesn't really need actors. He just kind of drapes them across motorcycles and says, hey, look pretty. Whereas Alice Eve is a very attractive woman. She actually had a role in this. She was there for something other than just looking pretty. Zoe Saldana is an attractive woman, but her character has more to do than just look pretty sitting in front of a console. She actually plays a part. She is a useful member of the crew. In fact, everybody is a useful member of the crew.
I don't know about that little guy who goes around with Scotty.
He's Scotty's sidekick. Even sidekicks prove a use. He's what allows Simon Pegg to be funny.
Yes, Dr. Wortham. Sidekicks have their uses.
And not in that way. That was one of the things that was pointed out by, I believe it was Matt. He said that in spite of the fact that the three leads really are Kirk, Bones, and Spock, everyone had a role to play in this film. It wasn't the Picard and Data movie with everybody else being set dressing. In this case, everyone had an important part to play, and they showed that they were really good at it.
Okay, the Picard and Data movie was just incredibly awful. I would argue that was worse than Star Trek 1, but I can tell you in two words why that movie was so bad. Rick Berman.
Yeah, the fact that he still works in Hollywood is kind of disappointing.
We can't all be J.J. Abrams. It's funny that J.J. Abrams not only gets the old Star Trek, but he understands what young people want to see in movies.
Of course, Kirk has his role to play. Spock has his role to play. Bones has his role to play. Uhura shows that, yes, having a communications officer on board is actually a helpful thing. Sulu gets his chance to shine. Scotty really gets a chance to be a breakout in this.
And it's funny because he's really in just a small portion of the movie, but a very important portion of the movie.
And Chekhov has an important role. In a lot of ways, he's almost the comic relief in that role, but it's still an important role for him to play.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
If there were any throwaways, I would say probably the first 80% of Pike's appearance might have been throwaway, but the last 20% makes up for it.
Yeah, what was with those sideburns, anyways? I almost think he was Commodore Ilvis.
Well, he's left the building.
That he has.
For the most part, I do think that this was a very well-written movie, though. Would I have liked it to have steered a little bit further away from Star Trek II? Yes. But what was there was very well-written.
For me, the only thing that I didn't like was the fact that, once again, the Federation was the bad guy. No. Federation is always the good guys. Again, spoiler, you could see at the very beginning of this movie, Khan manipulating a Federation officer and committing an act of evil. If the overall premise was the big admiral was also doing Khan's bidding, that would have made more sense to me.
It would have been a little bit easier to swallow, yes. Speaking of the big admiral, how was it seeing Peter Weller at a film again?
That was awesome.
Peter Weller is one of those actors. Really, Peter Weller plays Peter Weller. He's another one of those types of actors. But he plays Peter Weller few and far enough between that each time you see him, you go, yeah, that's Peter Weller, but God, it's Peter Weller. Come on.
He just does science fiction so well. Because he does, I don't know if it's just scenery chewing or if he just takes the part so seriously. I don't understand exactly what it is. But he's just got that sci-fi cred.
So you've got Peter Weller nicely chewing on any scenery that's around him. You've got Benedict Cumberbatch, who, just his voice alone, when he chooses to emote, is menacing enough that he makes an excellent bad guy. I am so looking forward to hearing him as Smaug in the second Hobbits movie. I think he's just going to do a wonderful job of it. And he just carries himself throughout this entire movie as a force to be reckoned with. It doesn't even have to be a action sequence. He can be standing in the brig being questioned, and he leaves no doubt in your mind that he is in charge.
You know, that is such a good point. I mean, he is so good in this role. It's like Khan is another force of nature, not even a person. There's a scene where he's in the sick bay and he's surrounded by security guards and he's sitting absolutely perfectly still. And you realize the only reason those security guards are alive is because he's sitting absolutely perfectly still.
And that in spite of the fact that he's sitting there with handcuffs and six guns pointed at him, if he wanted, he would get up and leave, leaving carcasses in his wake. And for those of you who watch Sherlock, you know what this man looks like. He's not a physical powerhouse. He's not somebody that you'd sit there and go, yeah, who would win in an arm wrestling match? Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime or Benedict Cumberbatch? That's not a question that would come to mind.
And yet in this movie, you could say, who would win in a fight? Godzilla or Khan?
And if you're placing your money on anybody but Khan, it's a sucker bet.
I could see the end of that fight. It's Khan riding on Godzilla's back, just telling him, kill those people there.
And Godzilla being able to speak English, saying, yes, sir, whatever you say, sir. Just please don't hurt me anymore, sir. This is the type of presence that he's able to exude in this film. And like I said, even when he's sitting still, he makes it perfectly known that, yes, this is Kirk's ship, and yes, Kirk is in charge, and yes, Kirk has all these guns on him. But that doesn't mean that Kirk's going to win.
The only reason you're alive is because I'm letting you breathe.
Spock is able to realize that Khan is a force to be reckoned with. He knows that unless something is done, there's no way that they're going to be able to beat Khan. So he pulls his ace in the hole out, which led me to the greatest surprise in this film, for me personally, because I went out of my way to avoid spoilers on this thing. The fact that John Harrison was Khan, yeah, I kind of knew that, but before a single scene of footage was filmed, people were saying that he was Khan, so there was no way to not get that spoiler. But for me, the greatest surprise was the return of Leonard Nimoy.
That was awesome seeing him back.
Spock resorts to cheating, which I just thought was fantastic. So, we've got this rebooted universe. This is the second film in that rebooted universe. We've discussed, after seeing the first Star Trek film, what you thought of the reboot. Have your thoughts changed any since then?
Probably, but I don't remember that far back. That being said, it's Star Trek, and it's J.J. Abrams. There can be no wrong.
I've had a lot of people who have said that they were surprised by the fact that I like the reboot so much, because we really are diehard Star Trek fans.
I would definitely agree with that.
So there are a lot of people who think that we should be outraged by the reboot on general principle because, well, it's not the same universe. They rebooted. And I always tell them it's the way that they rebooted it that I respect. They didn't go out and say, no, 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 this other stuff never existed. They said, it existed, something has happened, welcome to a new universe.
It existed, and now we erased it. I guess I can understand that as being painful to somebody as old as me and as fond as the original Star Trek is going. And I just have one thing to say. Did you ever see Spock's brain? Do you really mind that being erased?
See, I don't necessarily look at it as that universe is erased. I see that as being it's another universe. I like to go with the whole parallel dimensions theory, where the Star Trek that we grew up loving is still out there. There are still stories to be told. It's just that at a certain point, reality diverged, and now this is a new dimension.
I agree with you, and so does CBS and Paramount, because they continue to license old universe stuff that has the likeness of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and Forrest Kelly on it, and you have new universe stuff which has the likeness of Christopher Pine, Zachary Quinto, and Carl Urban on it.
That's because instead of seeing faces, they see dollar signs.
Yeah, if you've ever wondered what's in one of those little Starfleet symbols, look really close. It's a dollar sign.
And I'd be willing to bet that if somebody could approach CBS with a marketable idea that is set in the Roddenberry universe, the original universe, and they thought that they could make some money on it, you better believe that they would be all over it, they'd produce it, they'd get it out there, because it would make them money. The Abrams universe is their number one thing right now because it has made more money just in these two films than anything that was produced in the last 10 years of Star Trek being on television.
Let's face it, the last 10 years of Star Trek on television were Voyager and Enterprise. And much as I love Scott Bakula and I liked Enterprise, yet those were not good years.
I'm even including the four movies.
Okay, I can concede that.
It's all about the Benjamins.
No, that's Deep Space Nine.
Spencer! So, how many pens in the pocket protector and overall thoughts?
It gets 3 3/4 pens in the pocket protector. I'm reserving that last quarter of a pen because of Federation being the bad guy in this one. I thought it was awesome. In its own way, I think it's an incredible sequel to Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And I would love to see J.J. Abrams continue to make Star Trek movies, and I hope that his license with Star Wars doesn't hurt that.
Well, if the rumors are true, he probably will focus more on Star Wars, but with the end of this film, it felt like a nice handoff point so that somebody else could take over the Star Trek franchise without any difficulty. They're starting something, quote-unquote, new, and whoever the new showrunner is can take it in whatever direction that they want to. I'm fine with that. I'd love for Abrams to stick around. I also know that he's only one man, and he can only do so many projects, and he's always said that he loved Star Wars more than Star Trek. I will say that I'm really hoping that for Star Trek 3, 13, whatever number you want to give it, I hope that they do come up with something original for themselves, something that is completely unique to them. I saw a great interview with Simon Pegg where he explained the lens flare. And while the explanation makes perfect sense, that the lens flare is there to kind of give it a documentary feel more than a we're all on a bunch of sets that have been adjusted specifically so that there's no reflective light. So I understand why the lens flare is there, but after a while it does start to get a little bit old. I wouldn't mind if it got drawn back significantly in future films. When you're getting lens flare off of Carol Marcus's uniform, there's too much lens flare. And I know that lens flare is everybody's big, oh, let's hop on this subject so that we can beat the snot out of J.J. Abrams for this directorial choice. That's not what I'm doing, folks. I'm just simply saying, I understand why it's there. I wouldn't mind a little bit less of it. But if it's the difference between getting a good story that has lens flare or getting a really lousy story with no lens flare, I'll put up with the lens flare.
Yeah.
And as far as ratings go, I'm going to go 3 out of 4 pens in the pocket protector. I still thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm still really looking forward to it coming out on DVD so that I can purchase it and rewatch it over and over and over and over again. But I can't say that I would go out of my way to see it in the movie theaters again, especially with ticket prices at the price they are.
As always, we thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We would appreciate your feedback. Please write Jim at twerponline.net. We can also be found on Zynga, Facebook, MySpace, and Twitter.
Thanks for listening, everybody. TwerpCast is a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions. Copyright 2013.
Shh! It.